So our reading this morning is from someone we've all heard of, Gandhi. And sometimes, you know, these folks that we hear about so ubiquitously, we forget to listen to what they're actually saying. That ever happened to you? Happens to me. So there's a terrific collection of readings in the back of your hymnal, which I know you never read during the sermon, because you're so engaged. But this is found there. It's a terrific one. And we need to respond in kind to Jane and to Rita, who are going to read it for us, with this phrase: it is possible to live in peace. So say it with me. It is possible to live in peace.
If someone with courage and vision can rise to lead in nonviolent action, the winter of despair can, in the twinkling of an eye, be turned into the summer of hope.
It is possible to live in peace.
Nonviolence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our being.
It is possible to live in peace.
Nonviolence, which is a quality of the heart, cannot come by an appeal to the brain. It is a plant of slow growth, growing imperceptibly, but surely.
It is possible to live in peace. If a single person achieves the highest kind of love, it will be sufficient to neutralize the hate of millions.
It is possible to live in peace.
If we are to reach real peace in this world, and if we are to carry on a real war against war, we have to begin with the children.
It is possible to live in peace.
The future depends on what we do in the present.
It is possible to live in peace.
So we've lived in a week, you and I, when it's been easy to see what America is forgetting to be, when the words risky behavior have been on the top of the fold of the newspaper in reference to the toddler behavior in Washington, and when your beloved team and my beloved team have risked winning and losing in the ninth, creating in us a risk of stress and high blood pressure. It's a good time for us to shift our eyes and our energy on someone who, though riveted with fear, did not let fear drive her actions and risked it all to save everyone but herself. So first we have to meet Mike. Mike grew up in a southern town in a southern state. And he and his older brother, Tim, were like any kids who grew up in the South. They were polite to a fault, and they addressed men as sir and women as ma'am, yes, ma'am. And spent their weekends with football and fishing. And though their parents were divorced, the home that they shared with their mother and stepfather was warm and supportive. Tim, the older brother, said, "We're just ordinary folk. Just regular." Mike was an energetic kid, and some called him hyper. So much so that when the mom took him to the doctor for his checkup, it was suggested that he try some medication to help him settle down a bit so that he could focus in class. And so began Mike's relationship with the pharmacy, the routine of taking pills in the morning and taking pills at lunch and then again in the evening, the task of remembering which ones to take when, with a full stomach and with an empty stomach. "I hate this," said Mike. "I hate it. Why do I need to take anything at all? Tim doesn't have to." Mike turned 13, and things began to change for Mike. Or rather, they began to change inside of Mike. increased anger, a furrowed brow, began to get wrinkles right there. Yelling at simple frustrations. He sounds like a teenager, doesn't he? And that's what Tim and his parents thought until the aggression and the threats began to occur. So in response, Mom took Mike to the doctor again, and they changed his medicine. They took one up, and they took another down, and they took one up again, and they took another one down. And when that didn't work, the doctor said, maybe it's time for Mike to go to a facility for a month to get him used to his medications. An experience that Mike never forgot, and an experience that Mike never forgave. And from there, Mike spiraled down. And his aggression escalated up. One night, October evening, Mike set fire to the family's home with 8 people in the rooms sleeping. It was caught right before it began to spread. And at another point, you know how when you're sleeping and you feel something that's close to you? Ever have that experience? Mom woke up to see Mike above her bed with a knife. It's such a risk having Mike home now, Mom said. It's dangerous. But he stayed. Where else could he go? What else could they do? No health insurance. They could not afford to put him into another facility. And he couldn't take care of himself. So Mom and Stepdad and Tim did the best they could, as people do. They locked up all the knives in the entire house in the trunk of the car and the matches. And they hid the keys from Mike, and they prayed for the best. You know, in economics class and on the New York trading floor, they have a phrase for this kind of response to a threat. They call it risk management, right? The family called it something else. They called it desperation. Now, the police were mostly uninvolved with Mike all the way through his adolescence until Tim called them one summer afternoon, telling them that he just turned on his iPhone and he just pressed the button to open up his Facebook account, and there was a message from Mike to Tim threatening him, threatening his brother, his only sibling. Said Tim, I honestly had no other words for it except fear. Fear is all that I felt. And so the police found Mike and they arrested him for making threats and they sentenced him to 3 whole years of probation and an anger management class. 2 nights. So let's leave Mike. Let's leave Mike right here for us. And let's meet Antoinette. The last year for her have been especially difficult. You know, it's always a challenge to make ends meet when you're an administrative assistant. And because her son lived at home, who had multiple disabilities, she left work every single day and began her second shift at home to care for him, leaving little time for herself, little time for the things that she wanted to do, little time for hopes, little time for desires, little time to catch a game in the evening. Do you ever feel like that with all of your obligations? There's just no time, no time. Indeed, the only thing that Antoinette gave herself was church every Sunday morning, where the longtime pastor taught her how to pray on the inside. Anchor yourself in God, Antoinette, he said, no matter what is happening around you. That skill of praying on the inside was one that she had put to use every day since that afternoon last fall when her husband went to work in the morning and never came home in the afternoon, citing irreconcilable differences. They had been married 33 years, and he was gone. And so that winter was especially dark for Antoinette, dark despite the sun and the light of a southern winter. All the northerners coming down on vacation and saying her in the CVS line, you know, you are so blessed to live here. The weather is so great. It's so beautiful. As if Antoinette's thinking the weather could make up for the loss. As if. One particular day, when she couldn't seem to find the words to pray on the inside, and God felt so far away from her, and the whole of her life seemed to stretch out on the road, one obligation after another, so much to do, so much sadness, so much loss, this whole road. And she tried to call her pastor, and he didn't pick up the phone. Antoinette, in the middle of the night, succumbed to the fear and the resignation. And out of the medicine cabinet in the bathroom, she took a whole handful of pills and swallowed them whole. Just so I could sleep, she said. Just so I could sleep and put this life behind me. Maybe, maybe forever. The next day, because for Antoinette there was a next day, she awoke in the hospital. Terribly ashamed, nauseous, sick, head hurting. And could she admit it? She was relieved. When her eyes cracked open in the bed, she saw her pastor sitting next to her. He was holding her hand. If she couldn't pray on the inside, then he could do it for her. And he said to her, Antoinette, we all go through something in life. We all go through something in life. Hold on, Antoinette. Hold on. And so now 10 months pass, and it is a bright August morning, and it's humid, and it's hot. It's the South. Where are all those northerners now? Thought Antoinette as she unlocked the front doors and she turned on the lights and she sat at her desk, readying herself for another day of work. Teachers stroll in. Morning, morning, honey, morning. Bell rings. Where does Antoinette work? At a school. And now the students begin to roll in. Morning, morning, hey, get back in the line. Girls, what are you doing? Morning, babies, go on now, go to class. And in all the frenzy of the morning arrivals, the bell tells everyone that it's time for homeroom to begin. Antoinette did not see the young man walk into the front room right in front of her desk. His eyes are lean and his brow is furrowed like this. Again, there's this crease. I don't have anything to live for, he says to her. What? Excuse me? I said, I don't have anything to live for. I don't care if I die. And it was then that Antoinette noticed what he was holding, a black matte barrel and a clip 9 inches long, and around his waist, clip after clip of magazines. And then he fired one round into the floor. Now, since last December, Antoinette had been trained and trained and trained about what to do in situations like this. But because this training happened right after her suicide attempt, she really didn't listen, she didn't think. Is this a drill? You know, they're trying to test me. This is a really good act. They're trying to test me, she said. No, they were not. So under the desk, she pressed the button that signaled to the two office colleagues and to all the teachers a phone tree and said, put the kids in safety and lock the doors. And police were there in 2 minutes. Is that them coming? The young man said. Did you do something? Is that them coming? And he turned on his heels and he ran out the front door, that black matte barrel, and he unloaded a clip at the officers approaching, the officers hiding behind walls and trees. Not one of them hurt. And inside, Antoinette, while the young man is outside shooting, she picks up the phone and she dials 911. And she says to the dispatcher, I am in the front office. He just went outside and he started shooting. Can I run? Can I run? What should I do? Can I run? What would you do? You're frightened for your life. What would you do? Do you run? Antoinette takes deep breaths. You know, she's gripping the phone so hard. You know, they talk about white-knuckled fear. It's just like that. She's gripping the phone so hard. Remember what the pastor said, she says to herself. Pray, pray on the inside. No, you don't run. He's coming back, Antoinette says to the dispatcher. Hold on. And there's silence and there's muffled voices, the way it sounds when you cover the phone. And then her voice to the dispatcher. The gentleman. Do you hear that? The gentleman, she says, referring to the young man. Is this Southern manners? Is this something intentional? The gentleman said, tell the police to back off or he'll start shooting. He says he doesn't want to hurt the kids. He says he's here for the police and he's not mentally stable, he says. Silence on the phone. Antoinette, he said he should have gone to the mental hospital instead of come to the school. Because he's not on his medication. The ones that were up and down and up and down. Deep breaths, Antoinette. Prayer on the inside. Is this a risk worth taking, talking to this man? Is this a risk worth trying? Trying to keep this man calm. Antoinette, too, the young man. Honey, I can help you. Let's see if we can work it out so you don't have to go away for a very long time. What's your name? Michael. Mike. Mike Hill, he says to Antoinette. You know, honey, that's my name too. My mama was a Hill. She's praying on the inside, and she's praying not just for herself. She's praying on the inside for this man with a gun, a practice that her pastor taught her that helped view Mike not just as a dangerous person, but as a struggling person, a struggling soul. Religion did that. For all of those who say, religion doesn't do anything. Religion did that. To the dispatcher, Antoinette says he wants to go to the hospital. He wants to give himself up. To Mike, she says, I will go there with you. Don't feel bad, baby. Don't feel bad, baby. Sit there, stay calm. Don't worry about it. Now, maybe now is a good time to tell you, in case you didn't know, that Mike is a white young man, 20 years old in the South, and Antoinette is a middle-aged African-American woman. This is the South, where this past summer, the killer of an unarmed African-American teenager claimed that his fear justified his actions as he shot him and was found not guilty. Fear justified his actions. Was it a risk for Antoinette to reach across race and fear? Was it? Was it a risk worth taking? You know, Mike is a stranger to Antoinette. He's a frightening and violent stranger. But did you listen to her? She spoke to him like he was a member of her family. What's your name? Michael Hill. Baby, that's my family. My mama was a Hill. To Mike, Antoinette says, it's gonna be all right, sweetie. Really? Sweetie? And the next words, it's gonna be all right, sweetie. I want you to know that I love you. I'm proud of you. We all go through something in life, Mike. You know, I thought the same thing, she says. I tried to commit suicide after my husband left me in the fall. I got a son that's multiple disabled, but look at me now. I'm still working and everything is okay. It's gonna be all right, sweetie. I love you. Are you listening, First Parish in Sherbourne? Is America listening? Her whole 9/11 call, which today when you get home, I want you to go onto your computer, you can listen to all 24 minutes. It's a portrait of poise and compassion and bravery and courage and selflessness. As one commentator has put it, Antoinette is exactly, she is precisely what America is forgetting to be. I love all of you, each and every one of you, I do. And with you, I am tired. I'm so exhausted of the fear mongers and the naysayers and the terrorizers getting all of the headlines, getting all the pulpit time. I'm tired of apologizing for people and churches that I don't belong to and the partisans that I don't agree with for doing all the damage. I'm tired. I want to live with you in a world where Antoinette stands at the center of the circle and she's got the microphone. And we are gathered around her, sitting in a circle, and we are listening. What helped Antoinette decide that day that it was worth the risk to stay and talk to Mike? What allowed her to risk not only herself for the sake of the children, but also risk herself for the sake of Mike, that dangerous person who was a hurting person too? What allowed her to not let fear drive her actions so that she could say, shh, Mike, stay calm. It's going to be all right, sweetie. I love you. You know, it's easy with people like Antoinette for us to sit here and think that she's a hero so that we are left off the hook and think that she doesn't ask us to do anything or be anything in the world. It's so easy to do that. So I want to leave you with some questions to take with you into your week. What risk does Antoinette give you the courage to take? Who or what or where is waiting just on the edge for your bravery? Are you ready? Are you ready? What will it take for you to be ready? And for strength, remember, may we learn how to pray on the inside. Friends, say with me, amen.